The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. The more you know about our meat, the better. That's the bottom line at Whole Foods Market. Our standards require no added hormones and no antibiotics, ever. Our partnerships with farmers and ranchers allow us to offer the highest quality local and organic choices. And our newest program, the Global Animal Partnership's 5-Step Animal Welfare Rating, sets unprecedented standards in the industry for beef, pork, and chicken. Standards you can see, labeled, when you walk into our stores. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com for more information on the 5-Step Rating. Because, hey, the more you know, the better.
This is Sunday morning. It's time for the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting to you live from the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street, where brunch is now being served. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime.
Hello.
That would be Patrick Martins there. And our engineer and producer today is the inimitable, the wonderful, and the extraordinarily explosive Jack Inslee.
He's explosive.
I just thought I'd say that because he's just exploding with talent. But we have a great show today. We have a really interesting show. First, we'll have Dave Arnold, who does a wonderful show here on the network.
He has our number one rated show.
Yeah. And number 9 of all food shows on iTunes, right?
iTunes, yeah. He's also the director of, I think, technology.
Culinary technology at the French Culinary Institute.
He's also the founder of the Museum of Food and Drink, which is one of the things we'll be talking to him about.
That's right. And we'll be talking about the Museum of Food and Drink right now, as well as during that interview, just to kind of warm people up. Our fundraiser, our inaugural fundraiser for the Museum of Food and Drink, is coming up on March 27th. That's a Sunday. It'll take place at Del Posto Restaurant, one of Mario Batali's wonderful restaurants. The kitchen is helmed by the excellent Mark Ladner. And we have an incredible all-star cast of chefs who are going to be contributing their talents and their time and energy to this inaugural fundraiser.
Cesare Cazella from Sola Maria Rossi, David Chang from Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne from WD50, Brooks Headley from Del Posto, Mark Ladner from Del Posto, Carlo Miracci from Roberta's, Nils Norin from FCI, and Christina Tosi from Momofuku Milk Bar. We also have bartenders Damon Bolte, Jamie Gordon, Kenta Goto, Eben Clem,
and Audrey Saunders,
and Thomas Watt.
From Death and Company. And yep. Audrey, of course, from the incredible Pegu Club, which, if you haven't visited, is really a fantastic experience.
So we're going to talk all about this very important food museum, because it's funny, you know, my favorite museum in the world is the Natural History Museum, which is all wild animals. And I was like 18 years old before I even saw a wild animal. Meanwhile, food, I eat 3 or 5 times a day, and there's no museum about food.
That's right.
So it's a kind of a funny thing.
Yeah, and there, I don't think anyone around the world has created anything quite like what...
There's SOFAB in New Orleans, but there's not a natural history museum of food. So that's going to be really interesting. We also have Stefan Cantor, who was one of the first vendors at Green Market, and it is her season right now because she is a maple syrup producer, and so she has all these lines hanging from trees, and her life's about to get crazy for the next 3 weeks.
And some of us from Heritage Foods are going to be going up to lend a hand and make a movie, and
our goal is to get in the way. 1,000 liters of our goal is to sell 1,000 liters of this maple syrup because, you know, maple syrup should be eaten fresh too, even though it lasts forever.
That's right.
So I'm very excited about the maple syrup. It's kind of the first of a series of quote-unquote social buys that, you know, we try to virally market some idea on behalf of a farmer. And it's almost like in the vein of the slow food Presidium, which is in the, Presidium is a Latin word for garrison. So it's almost like a militaristic type approach towards defending a farm and saving a food and selling a food and, you know, making a big to-do about something that deserves it. So The maple syrup, we're going up there, we're tapping the trees, we're boiling the syrup in the sugar house.
And then we're marketing it through Heritage Foods USA.
Yeah, and then
USA.
We're selling it, and that is the key, we're selling it. Yeah. And then a couple of weeks later, we're down to North Carolina to sell triggerfish, same thing, off the docks, wrap it in butcher paper, overnight it to people around the country so they can celebrate this unbelievable fish. So, Katie, you've been researching triggerfish. Tell us, what's its story?
Well, there are literally dozens of varieties of triggerfish, and it's a very, in many cases, a very beautiful fish. I'm not sure exactly which variety they will be catching off of North Carolina, but it was originally considered sort of bycatch. Nobody really thought that triggerfish was going to be as delicious. They would be fishing for something else, like flounder or hake or something down in those southern waters, and they would come up with triggerfish, and they usually throw them out and or throw them back into the water. So then somebody decided they would try it, and it turned out to be a fish that is basically just like eating scallops. It's sweet. It's mild. It pairs well with lots and lots of different kinds of flavorings, and it's really easy to cook. So the Times actually had a nice piece about triggerfish a few weeks ago, and we'll be going down there with our Golden Boys.
And that's Dan and Andrea, mail order guy.
Getting right down onto the docks with the fishermen, and they'll be bringing them in. They catch them by line, hook and line. This is all, we got a lot of help with our partners, Sean and Michael Dimon from Sea to Table.
And you can do a search for Sea number 2 Table or Dimon, D-I-M-I-N, on the Heritage Radio Network
website. Yeah, because they've been on
website.
The show to talk about what they do and the business that they have, which is sort of the seafood counterpoint to
Heritage Foods. Which is also very important, because if you want to save it, you have to sell it. And so then we also have lamb is another kind of social buy, and we're going to be selling, Heritage Foods will be selling Tunis lamb this year, Katahdin lamb, Romney lamb, by pieces, but also the best way to buy it, by the half lamb cut into its respective pieces. So you get a few weeks of lamb.
Spectacular meals.
And you end up paying less per pound, like around $12, $14 per pound when you buy a half lamb. So that's
when you consider that a rack of lamb, for instance, can go for as much as $32 a pound, that's a pretty good buy.
And then we're going to have Dave in a couple minutes, but just other little notes. The Snacky Tunes show has just compiled a best of CD, which is going to be compiled, or it's going to be premiered on the Heritage Radio Network website this week. And other news is, I think we've gone through the first phase of approval for 501c3 status for the network.
Wahoo. So
which
that means
it'll be easier for you, the listener, to help us sustain our
programming.
It'll be a
tax-deductible donation.
And then we'll be like NPR every 4 to 5 minutes throughout the year. We will be reminding
you. Actually, I did a lot of driving this week, and it's their fundraiser
I know.
Right now.
You can tell every minute.
Oh, man. It was really bad on Friday. But it was, you know, They kept it down to a dull roar today.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, we are going to take our break and come back with Dave Arnold and talk about MOFAD.
Welcome back to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martin.
And our guest today by phone is the fabulous, the one and only,
indomitable,
the incredible Dave Arnold.
Wow. How you guys doing?
Hey, we're great.
Hey, Dave.
How you feeling, Dave?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
That's great. Are you excited about the opening of MOFAD? Or not the opening, but the inaugural fundraiser for MOFAD?
Get the ball rolling event.
Well, I'm super excited. I mean, our hope obviously is that we're going to raise awareness for what we're trying to build, and also hire someone full-time who can do some hard-hitting, serious fundraising in the next couple of years. I mean, we're hoping, I think, to get to open in about 5 years' time is what we're looking for. About what do you think, Patrick, about 5 years?
Yeah, I was going to say 4.5, but yeah, we can extend it to 5.
Not 4 3/4, though.
Yeah, no, 4 3/4 is a terrible number. 4.5 or 5. Yeah. 4 3/4.
Well, Dave, first, let's start with, like, how did you come up with the idea of the Museum of Food and Drink? What was the genesis of this concept? Because it is a kind of radical idea.
You know, 5 years ago, or 6 years ago now, when I first decided that this was something that I needed to do, there wasn't as much around. For instance, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum that exists now in New Orleans didn't have a place yet. There's a food museum done by New York Food Historical Museum that's dedicated to not have an actual place. But I really felt, actually on a visit to the Natural History Museum, that food needed a museum of that scope, a huge museum where you could actually go, physical place, go and taste. That, you know, food, you know, to me, food is culture, right? And that's how I experience culture. You know, I break bread with people. I meet with people when I go to other places within the United States or abroad. All I want to know is how they eat, what they eat. That's how I experience things. And so I wanted a place that people could go where that was the primary focus. So a Smithsonian or a Natural History Museum of food. But, you know, as you know, Patrick knows, you know, you don't start a museum like that overnight. You know, that takes many, many decades, you know, 50, 60, 70 years to get to that size. So the idea is to start out small, but to be kind of heavy hitting from the beginning.
So now, for instance, when you first came out with that idea, I mean, who did you just sit down one day at your Commodore 64 and write all this stuff down? Or did you talk to people? I mean, you had already, you know, taken some steps. So tell us really about the beginning of this fabulous idea.
Right. Well, I didn't have enough money for a Commodore 64 at the time. Well, it was funny. I mean, at the time, I had some limited contacts in the food world. You know, I knew, you know, like Jeffrey Steingarten. I knew, you know, Wiley Dufresne at the time. But really what happened is I staged a very small exhibit in 2004 or 5 at, actually, I had a trade show at the Javits on American Country Ham. Mm-hmm. That exhibit came to the attention of the amazing Michael Batterbury, who took a shine to me and basically, you know, thought the museum was, you know, a very good project, important, and had me writing for Food Arts Magazine. I wasn't originally, because, you know, anyone, I do technical, I'm the director of culinary technology at French Culinary Institute. You know, what I do in the food world is usually high-tech stuff, but at the time I was hired on at Food Arts to be a technical person and an historical person. Mm-hmm. And the idea was really to raise, you know, my profile in the food world so that I could accomplish this goal. Subsequently, Batterbury got me hired on to the French Culinary Institute, where I've been for the past 5 years, and unfortunately have been too busy to really advance the project. When Michael, unfortunately, you know, passed away last year.
Very tragically, this summer. Yes, past summer. Yeah.
Early, very early, way too early.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you never think someone like Michael's going to go.
Never.
You know what I mean? He's just such a presence. Anyway.
And for our listeners, I mean, he is the founder of Food and Wine magazine. Then he started an industry publication that was read
called
by really
Food Arts.
Every chef.
It is continues to be read by every chef.
And he was very good friends with people like Gus Schumacher, the assistant to the Department of Agriculture.
He was the Undersecretary of Agriculture in the Clinton administration.
He's
going to
be on next
week.
We'll
be our guest next week.
And he did things like Michael Batterbury with Gus, the New American Farmer, which brought people from, you know, other countries,
settled
them here.
He was very involved in Wholesome Wave with Michelle Nichon.
So anyway, very powerful and good connector.
Hugely influential and wonderful man, yeah.
Right, he, you know, and his wife, Ariane Butterberry, still runs
Food Arts,
right, they were,
absolutely,
you know, a team. And just an incredible duo. And, you know, a lot of things. You know, the full impact that they've had on the American food scene is never going to be known, because they never took credit for anything.
No,
you know, I mean,
true.
You know, it's crazy when you see all of the, you know, when you ask people, like, all the connections that that those two have made. I mean, for instance, you know, they were part of the switchover to make chefs in America have that be a professional designation, as opposed to just, you know, basically being a menial menial position. I mean, they did a lot of incredible things.
I mean, you would almost have to put him on the level of a James Beard or a Julia Child.
Definitely.
I mean, that you're really talking about the top of the pyramid in terms of importance and respect, you know, from his peers and all that.
Yes.
Exactly. He just didn't have as high a profile among people who weren't
among
in
consumers.
The industry.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. He also, you know, was an amazing guy. But anyway, so it unfortunately took his passing for actually the three of us to have a conversation on actually this radio show about this project. And, you know, Patrick basically said, you know, this is something that needs to happen. And so here we are making it happen.
That's right.
And now this is really, I mean, let's just talk about this Get the Ball Rolling fundraiser. What's so much fun is that you pick these themes and you basically, talking with the chefs, assigned a theme to each chef. So,
an historical theme.
How did you come up with these themes? And tell us a little bit about a couple of them, because it's really wild. I've never seen an event like it.
Well, okay, so some of the stuff, you know, basically I was just messing with people, you know. So it's like, for instance, and I think in a good way, pushing people, you know. So Wiley Dufresne, my brother-in-law, very widely known for doing kind of cutting-edge work, I gave him caveman food.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Just, you know, just to kind of, because one of the fun things about, like, Wiley is that, he's known for this, for doing this kind of high technology work, but in reality, you know, he was at John George for a long time. It's not like he can only do high tech. So I figure I'd give him the exact opposite.
Perfect.
Caveman.
How did you come up with?
And he's so imaginative. I know it's going to be a really interesting dish.
So tell us, Mark Ladner. What did you?
Well, Mark Ladner, right? So I gave him what on the one hand is obvious because he, you know, works at, you know, he's a chef, the chef at Del Posto, which is 4-star Italian. I gave him Roman, which again seems obvious and easy, but in fact, Roman cuisine, which he does, you know, he has studied it a bunch. But Roman cuisine is entirely different from modern Italian cuisine. The spice mix, the flavor mix, the techniques used for cooking, everything about it completely different from modern Italian cuisine. And so I think that's going to be an eye-opener for most of the guests, how different it is. The one problem with Roman cuisine, if you've ever cooked it, is everything looks horrible. It's incredibly ugly cuisine, so we'll see what he does with it. But, mm-hmm.
Well, and everything is going to taste like that fermented anchovy sauce of the garum, right?
Well, you'd think. But I don't know exactly what spices he's, you know, but I've cooked a bunch of Roman stuff.
Have you?
And, it's not all similar. It doesn't taste Asian, which is strange, even though it's got a bunch of fish sauce. It does taste like it could have come out of the Mediterranean, but the spice mixes are things like asafoetida, which of course gives like an allium
sulfur.
Kind of oniony flavor. Yeah, sulfurous in that way. What did you say?
The Indian cuisine uses a lot of asafoetida.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the Romans used it a lot. In fact, there was a type of that was laser, which came, I think, from Libya, that they made extinct because they used it so much. Yeah, and then they had to switch to asafoetida, which is, you know, was their lesser of the two prized similar things. They used a lot of lovage seed. It's really an interesting cuisine.
No, I can't wait to try this. It's going to be great.
Now, David Chang of Momofuku, he was given a very challenging cuisine because, you know, I don't ever imagine foods of Native Americans in this country being, you know, exploding with taste or diversity or something. But how did you come up with his theme of American food in 1491?
Well, I wanted to give him something challenging, and I also really wanted to highlight the difference in cuisines that happened as a result of the plant exchange that went on after the New World and the Old World had massive amounts of contact.
Right.
And it would have been much easier to give him, let's say, for instance, Asian food before the advent of the red pepper, which is a similar problem. But that stuff is much better documented than what was going on in the U.S. Prior.
Sure.
And so I gave him that one because it was challenging, and because I thought he, you know, he's fascinated with acorns. Is one of the things he's fascinated with, and acorns are a well-known Korean ingredient and a well-known Native American ingredient.
Yes, so definitely.
So I thought maybe he could use that, but he went on a on an insane research binge and had, you know, everyone on his staff looking this stuff up. He called three or four anthropologists. He called the leaders of some Native American nations. He called.
No kidding.
He's going completely crazy. And his result is that we know more about what a Stegosaurus ate than what the Lenape Lenape people in Manhattan ate in 1491. And he's kind of upset about it, actually. Not about what we gave him, but just about that fact, because I think that, you know, most people don't really know that. So that was very challenging, and I'm anxious to see what he... I'm excited to see, rather, what he's going to come up with. Carlo from Roberto got... he actually chose, and I don't know what he's doing, but New York, 1784. So specific.
Just after the Constitution, all these big documents got signed. So,
so I mean, I don't know exactly what he's up to, but
glass shrimp or something I've seen on the menu.
Well, a lot of lobsters and oysters. Yeah. I mean, that's what people were eating, at least in New York.
Well, we definitely had we had a lot of it.
By the way, Michael Batterbury wrote a great book about the history of New York City restaurants.
That's
and
true.
He has
and
a
Ariane,
really significant chapter on that period. I thought he would just glaze over that, but, you know, this kind of concept of the inn, you know, that you would just stop by and eat a simple meal.
Right, well, that book... what's it called? On the town, right?
Yep, yes. On the town.
Yeah, is the actually definitive, even though it's, I don't know when they wrote it, maybe a decade or two ago, is still the definitive work on the history of restaurants in New York.
Yeah.
So Nils Noren from the French Culinary, my partner in crime, I gave him fad diets because I thought that would be hilarious.
Yes, that will be funny. Hilarious.
Yeah. So
now tell me, are these themes? Did you pick these themes with these chefs because you felt that they would become part of the museum curriculum? And how do you envision that curriculum? And is there a connection with these themes?
Yeah. Well, I think I chose these in part to be challenging to the individuals, and in part because I thought that guests might find them interesting, and in part because these are topics that I think are going to be dealt with. I think the history of nutrition. I mean, most people when they present nutrition, they present nutrition as here's what you need to do to eat to become healthy. I hate this sort of thing. I mean, I hate food. I don't like looking at food as a medicine. I like to look at it as something we enjoy to eat. And so, to me, it's much more interesting to explore the flip side of nutrition, the bad side of nutrition, which is, and you look at the history of these fad diets, which show, kind of how we've perverted the idea of nutrition over the ages. And it's not like fad diets are new. They've been around since forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's definitely an interesting topic. Also, obviously all the historical ones are in line with what we would be doing in the museum.
Now tell us, this museum, you want it to be a place where people are actually eating, but also seeing fun things. So, we haven't really talked about the mission, the trajectory of how you envision this museum when you founded it.
Right. Well, before we do that, let me just hit the two desserts, because I don't want to leave the dessert guys out.
Of course.
Yeah, so Brooks Headley from Del Posto, I gave him, and this is the only one I gave him that's personal, is I gave him Jewish desserts in Italy. And it's because my stepfather's family was part of the group of formerly Jewish people who were expelled from Spain,
settled
in Italy, and brought with them a huge culinary tradition. And so there's a bunch of these kind of hidden Jewish desserts in Italian cuisine, like a lot of chestnuts. So I don't know what he's doing, but it's an interesting little subset of culture that I thought was fun.
My ex-husband actually wrote a book about that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, about the Jews being expelled, yeah.
Nice.
And the whole, yes, absolutely. The Swine's Wedding, I highly recommend.
Huh, all right. I will check it out.
Yeah.
And And you know, you can tell because my stepfather's name is Adonisio, which derived from Adonai. But anyway, blah blah blah. And they they were lamb butchers in Italy for generations. Huh. Anyway, last but definitely not least, in the meals we're putting Christina Tozzi from Milk Bar, and I gave her space food.
Space food.
And pop.
And the reason I gave her space food, other than that it's fun, is that she writes a lot of the HACCP plans, which is Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point. Yeah, and it's what a lot of chefs who use kind of sous vide, this newer cooking technique, in restaurants have to do in New York City. They have to have HACCP plans, and HACCP was developed in part by big people like Pillsbury.
Sure.
For space food. For in fact, because you know, if an astronaut gets the runs in space, it can be a problem. Mm-hmm. So HACCP was designed as a part of the space program. That's why I gave her space food.
Very interesting.
And I know when we were, you know, working on the press release and everything for this, you're visualizing an entire part of the museum, or at least an exhibition about how space food has influenced the production, you know, mass production of food across the board, basically. What are some of the innovations besides HACCP that came up as a result of the space program?
Well, I think that's the biggest is HACCP. I mean, there's a lot of the packaging work that's been done, mm-hmm. but HACCP has single-handedly changed the entire industrial food production. I mean, it's only starting to touch us in the restaurant world, but it's completely. I mean, everything in an industrial level is HACCP. I mean, I think most people. You know, they think space food, they think freeze-dried ice cream, and then they're done.
Yeah.
Now that there's anything wrong with freeze-dried...
Pop Rocks.
Right, now that there's anything wrong with freeze-dried ice cream. Pop Rocks, you know, I met one of the inventors of Pop Rocks.
Really?
Yeah.
Dave,
yeah.
Did you see the
piece? He killed Mikey.
Well, I talked to him about that. He laughed his behind off. but I'll tell you one story he did tell me. I don't know if I'm allowed to tell it or not, but for those of you listening... Pop Rocks did not kill Mikey. As far as we know, Mikey is alive and well. Mm-hmm. But they did once ship a whole bunch of Pop Rocks in a semi that leaked, and it rained on the semi, and the semi blew out.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. So says the man who used to work on Pop Rocks.
Did you follow the fact that the inventor of cheese doodles? No, what are those? You know, those puffy cheese corn. You know, cool. What are those called? Yeah, like Jacks or cheese doodles.
Right.
That guy just died about 3 months ago.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, he was 93 years old.
Well, that's been around a while. Cheese doodles are made in what's called a twin screw extruder, and those are a development that we got from the plastics industry. But that's part of, Patrick and I have spoken a lot. We envision a big hall of grains, you know, in the museum, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, like, part of that is going to be, you know, a history of milling. So maybe we'll have a working mill to show people. But at the same time, we'd have a Matate Imano showing how things would be ground in Mesoamerica. We'd have Quern mills, other types of mills, because a lot of culture is determined by how grains were milled in different areas, like what the foods were and how they were made. So,
and then just the natural environment, like for instance, all the falling water of New England lended itself perfectly
to powering
these super big stones.
Sure, but you look at the difference in stone. So when Europeans took over corn from the Mesoamericans, we had a fairly advanced milling technology at that point, right? So we didn't have to use a lot of hand manual labor to do our milling. Our milling would already have been taken to a centralized location. We would have had our grain ground at a mill and then returned to us, okay? What that meant is we had the ability to grind hard, dry corn. So when corn got introduced to European diets, it was being ground on big mills without having been treated at all. In Mesoamerica, they were still grinding their corn on what's called the Matate Imano, big stone, basically they look like stone tables, by hand. In order to effectively grind that way, it's back-breaking labor. I've done it. It's brutal. But in order to do it more effectively, their corn was pre-cooked and soaked in alkaline water, a process called nixtamalization, that made it easier for them to mill it. But at the same time, it also made niacin available and increased the calcium content. So when the Europeans took the corn without taking that process, that nixtamalization process, we got things like pellagra and vitamin deficiencies because of the lack of niacin.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of interesting interrelated things in the way grain and culture has moved around the world. And then attached to that, though, and this is, we go back to corn doodles, and that, cheese doodles, next to that is going to be the hall of ready-to-eat, like the ready-to-eat cereal exhibit where we're going to have puffing guns, which was invented in the late, between the 1890s and 1904, when it was first shown at the St. Louis exhibition. Puffing guns, where puff cereals invented, extruded cereals, flaking rollers, I mean, amazing stuff.
I'm fascinated by all of those things.
Now, am I the only one who's still fascinated by taxidermy and thinking that, the breeds of pigs throughout history?
I was going to ask Dave earlier if he was planning on stuffing some, seminal chefs.
We're like Brie Savarin. We'll exhume him.
We'll have Madame Tussaud.
Or have Madame Tussaud, right? Yeah. I think we should, Dave. I think that's a great idea.
That would be funny
idea.
To see all the chefs.
Totally
Taillevin. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Taillevin. Yeah, or Escoffier.
Oh, man.
Or, the Toigros brothers. Or
for those of you out there, Patrick likes, if you've ever been to Patrick's office, Patrick enjoys some taxidermy. He has, some squirrels fighting.
That was Katie gave me that.
I purchased those for Patrick.
Awesome.
Aren't those an excellent thing?
Yes. Squirrels fighting in the corner of Patrick's office. Yes,
vicious little rodents with moth-eaten tails.
For Brunswick stew,
Well.
One of Patrick's great visions is to get a stuffed version of every important pig breed.
I think that's a good idea.
Or it could be the cow breed or something, but, it should
quite
be.
Big. Cow's a large thing.
I know, but that would be such an imposing and wonderful exhibit. You could do chickens. I mean, all of the early breeds, early pure breeds of
throughout
of
history,
livestock,
including the extinct kinds,
Absolutely.
And I think people would be like, wow, who knew that
look
they could
look
so
lost.
Different? Exactly.
But also look at what we've lost and what we need to return to the, agricultural community.
You know what's funny, though? We think of, the ancient breeds, take pigs, right?
Yeah.
Most of the old breeds that we, old breeds we have from England and Europe, with the exception of certain very, very old strains, were all improved, they say, by influx of genetics from China in the 1700s.
Oh.
To try and increase certain characteristics like speed of gain and mothering and stuff like that. So a lot of the older breeds changed radically in the 1700s because of influx of Chinese pig
genetics.
I mean, so there's been several waves of change in even in pigs. Obviously right now we're extremely we have an extreme dearth of diversity and our pigs have clearly become what they should not be.
Standardized,
but it's not like it hasn't been a constant source of change for generations. And the other cool thing about pigs, right, is that pigs return to a feral state very quickly.
Yeah.
Razorback, wild American razorback pigs are introductions. I mean, they're not native to here. All
right.
We had of peccaries and javelinas are the only things that were in on this continent prior to prior to the conquistadors showing up with pigs.
Right.
By the way, a couple of razorbacks broke into Newman's pens and mated with some of the sows. And so when we bring some of
did
those
you just
razorbacks,
make that up?
No, it's true. I mean, he's in the wilds of Arkansas.
In the Ozarks, yeah.
Yeah. So one day when we bring some of that in next, Dave, I'll be sure to ask you and to come and try it. But that reminds me, eating will be a big component of this. So how do you envision the eating and the education and the two kind of entwining?
Well, to me, look, we already have a lot of books on food, right?
Yes.
Thank God.
Too many.
And we have a lot of television shows on food.
Too many.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, the thing is that, I learn the most when I can smell, touch, and taste. Mm-hmm. That's when I learn the most. And so we're going to try to do as much of that in the museum as is possible. Smell, touch, taste, see. And I think that it provides a much better learning experience for certain things and definitely for certain people than just reading about it, although I love reading about things. You know what I mean? It's not like we're going to send out a bunch of plated plated products, because that's unreasonable. But you know, the way I think, you know, we've talked about it is that you would buy like a series of taste tickets, almost like, you know, like rides at an amusement park. Mm-hmm. And you would hand them in, and you would get, you know, if we were doing, you know, you go into the Apple exhibit, you'd hand in, you know, a taste thing, and then you could taste the 100 different varieties of apples we got shipped in from upstate New York that you know, for that, you know, month-long exhibit during apple season. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or
I like that.
Right? I mean, or, you know, we'd have just very simple, because we don't want to do a lot of cooking. It's not about plated things. It's about, you know, learning the difference. So, like, if we were going to have
prosciuttos or something, you could try Spanish, Italian, American, all on, like, at one time?
Right. Comparative side-by-sides. Or, you know, different grains. I mean, it's all about kind of showing fundamental differences and not about not about massive plated things.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I would imagine at any one time we're definitely going to have obviously one of the coolest museum cafes in the world, and mm-hmm. obviously one of the coolest specialty food gift shops, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's obvious.
That goes without saying, yes.
Right, but I mean, I imagine, you know, one of the early things I thought of the exhibit was, you know, what if we just shipped lock? I don't know if this is even feasible, but what if we shipped Lock, Stock, and Barrel, a street vendor from another country for 3 months, and just had them operating out of the museum, boom. You know what I mean? Like, that would be amazing.
That would be amazing.
Right. So you know, this is the kind of thing, hopefully, that you'd see when you go there.
You do have to be careful. I think I remember reading in that Natural History Museum book, they brought back some Eskimos, and they got sick and died or something like that. We have to make sure that doesn't happen.
No, but Dave, you know what I think is so cool about this? Is like, I think that for parents, that this would be an amazing destination if you were coming into, or I mean, even if you live mm-hmm. in New York, but if you were coming to visit New York and you have kids, the Museum of Natural History and the Museum of Food and Drink, I mean, mm-hmm. your kids would learn so much.
Yeah. And about, I love that it's a museum about quotidian things. I mean, that's actually a fascinating
thing.
But
I mean, as
a
child, what could be more interesting than seeing how they puff rice for Rice Krispies or, you know, make cheese doodles or seltzer water or anything like that? You know, I mean, that stuff is fun.
But,
all the technology things, I think, are really, really a cool idea.
And the puff rice is going to be loud. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. It's actually tremendous. Yeah. Well, the tickets are $250, and Dave has started a simple but informative website. It's MOFAD, MOFAD.org. And you can go to Eventbrite, MOFAD.Eventbrite, BRITE.com, and buy tickets that way.
Or just go to MOFAD.org, and it'll take you right to that Eventbrite page.
Yeah, MOFAD.org.
But the event is March 27th at 1 p.m. at Del Posto Restaurant. We urge anyone who is within walking or traveling distance to check it out and really consider coming to this. This is going to be the culinary event of the year.
There's no bigger project.
Yeah.
No project could be more important than getting, you know, a food museum, and this is the quality of the chefs who are going to be attending it prove that this is really something that's going to happen. So come and support it. There is actually really no higher calling than to educate future generations, you know, about
absolutely
food.
And from a selfish standpoint, I mean, this event, I don't know of any other meal being put on quite like it.
There mm-hmm. isn't. No, that's it. I mean, this is an absolutely once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to not only have the work of all these great chefs in one place, but secondly, to, you know, experience all of these historically based meals and really see what it was like hundreds or thousands of years ago.
And there's going to be a goodie bag that people
that's
take
right.
home.
Swag
there's
bag.
Going to
oh,
be
there's
a silent
auction
where all the chefs are going to sign a coat, you know, a kind of cooking coat. So, I mean, very, very important stuff. But Dave, before we head out, and thank you so much for taking time on a Sunday, Cooking Issues is really one of the best food radio shows anywhere.
Dave, we love you.
Do you have any? What are you going to be doing on this week's? Do you even know yet what your theme is this week?
No, I mean, usually what happens is people will. You know, write in email and call their stuff. So we try to do as much of, you know, based on what people are interested in talking about as possible. But, for instance, last week I severely burned my tongue on lye, on sodium hydroxide. So I'm sure...
Dude!
Yeah, it was kind of unfortunate. That'll, I'm sure, make its way into the discussion.
Oh, my God, Dave. What were you doing, dare I ask? Making hominy.
You know, here's the thing. I was dividing up a bunch of containers, you know, moving stuff around and someone presented me with an unlabeled quart container. I stupidly put my finger in and tasted a little bit of it, and it turns out it was rye.
Oh, for God's sake.
And it was unbelievable, unbelievably awful.
Oh, how painful.
Yeah, you know, you go to the, like, instant.
Did you go to the emergency room?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know.
Did they know how to help you?
Yeah, they all thought I was a, I can't say the word on the air, but you know
chemical
what I mean?
Burn.
So I'm sure things like that will make it into the conversation. I might have more to say about my recent Florida trip to eat fruit and upcoming fruit visits, things like that.
Sounds great. And
awesome.
I'm glad to hear that you're not lisping, so clearly you didn't loof.
Tongue is amazing. My tongue was literally bleeding.
Poor guy.
It melted the flesh on like one half of my tongue. And a day later, in the morning I was lisping. By the evening, it didn't even really hurt anymore. Now, it's true I'm totally jacked up on steroids. But your tongue's an amazing thing, you know?
That is extraordinary.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you. I'm glad you didn't burn off the whole thing, because then we wouldn't have cooking issues. No.
Yeah. It'll be a nightmare.
So you can't taste anything for another week or so, right?
No, one half was okay.
Okay.
And so, I can taste on that side, but really, the tongue bounces back like a trooper. It's amazing.
That's
the roof
amazing.
Of my mouth still hurts more than my tongue does.
Jesus, buddy.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, get better. I can't wait to hear the show this Tuesday. And thanks so much for being on.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave. This was really fun.
Any listeners, go to the event. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah. MoFad.org.
All right.
Thanks, Dave.
Because
I've got nowhere to go. Had me a job till the market fell out. Tried hard to borrow, but there was no help. Now I've got nowhere to go. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man. Nowhere to go. One last look at the land. Auctioneer with his gavel in hand, and he said, it's got to go. Worked this piece all my life. Broke my heart, then took my wife. Now I've got nothing to show. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man, nowhere to go. Wandered aimless in the city with my dirty work boots and old straw hat in hand, singing a song by Woody Guthrie. This land is your land, it ain't my land.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., Chef Erica Wides hits the airwaves to become your own personal chef instructor. Chef Wides, along with esteemed guests from the culinary world, dissect topics that range from the complex to the deceptively simple, combining classic culinary know-how, personal experiences, and the occasional virtual history lesson. Why We Cook is a great listen for culinary vets and rookies alike. Again, that's Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, man, are we happy to be back. That was a great interview with Dave Arnold. And now we have in studio someone who I've known for over 10 years back through Slow Food Days. When I was like, I need to learn about local farms. Let me go to the Green Market. And I would go to the Union Square Market. And so we have in studio Stefan Kanter from Deep Mountain Maple. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, Katie. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Are you kidding? A woman after my own heart.
Yeah, you guys, Katie fell in love with you already just in that 5 minutes were at the bar.
She had a big shot of whiskey in her coffee.
In her coffee.
Love a girl who can hold her liquor before dinner on Sunday.
And then we did our little shot of Fernet as well.
That's right. There was no grousing about that either. She went right for it.
It's great. Let's loosen right up and talk about it.
That's right.
So, Stefan, now one of the questions Katie and I, just to put in perspective for our listeners, maple syrup used to just get tapped. People would put a thing and make a hole in a tree. It would fall into a bucket and you would walk it to the sugar house. But things have changed since then. So can you tell us a little bit about your the technology and syrup and process? Because we are hitting maple syrup season right now.
Well, yes, I can. The big change you're talking about is the sort of switch from buckets, where, as Patrick said, you put a hole in the tree, you put a little spout in the hole, that spout has a little hanger on it, you hang a bucket, the sap falls in the bucket, you have to walk around to every tree and dump that bucket into a bigger bucket and dump that into a tank on a sled pulled by a horse or a tractor and take it to the sugar house, where you pour it into a big tank before you boil it to make the syrup. That's pretty labor-intensive. Sugaring is labor-intensive in general, but nowadays, almost everyone doing it on any large scale uses plastic tubing.
Now, were you reluctant? Because I know you and Howie didn't probably just jump at the first technological innovation. It probably took you a while to convert.
Correct. We actually try never to jump at the next technological innovation. Mm-hmm. And in this case, was the same. There was a little, shall we say, marital tension over whether or not we should switch to from buckets to tubing, because Howie, my husband, is the one who does all or most of the boiling, the actual transformation of the sap into syrup. So he was in the sugar house all day waiting for us to bring the sap to him. So he saw no good reason why we shouldn't just keep doing it that way.
Right.
But those of us who were actually out in the woods sloshing through the snow, trying not to spill any, thought, well, maybe we should check out this new technology. So we didn't go all at once from buckets to tubing. We did it little by little. And then it soon became evident that that was kind of crazy, because the timing, the sort of the rhythm of the day is different with buckets and with tubing. And so we were finding it difficult to stay on top of everything. So eventually we switched our entire operation over to tubing. And I have to say, I think we've done so without any decrease in the quality of the syrup, which is our ultimate aim, that we can make the best syrup possible. So we think we still do.
So how do the line, tell us just about tubing, and then Katie has a question, but like, what does that mean? I understand the concept of a tube from a tree, but it's
sure,
a complicated.
Sure, but they're all interconnected.
Yeah, okay.
Thousands of meters of these things throughout the property.
Right, so let's think about it. In the easiest way to conceptualize it is to think of plumbing the woods.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because really, sap is a thin liquid like water. Maple sap, when it comes from the tree, is 1.5 to 2% sugar, and the rest is water and minerals. So you want to get this watery liquid from the tree to the sugar house, which is the name of the building where we boil the sap into syrup. So really, you're just plumbing the woods, which means specifically that you still drill a little hole in the tree, you still put a spout in the hole, but that spout now, instead of the sap dripping into a bucket, is now connected to a little piece of plastic tubing. This is 5/16 inch tubing. It's very small. And that sap, it, that little piece is called the drop line that goes from the spout to the to another line of plastic tubing. So it goes from that into bigger plastic tubing, and from that into a bigger line. So finally, we have like a 1-inch line of sap gushing into a tank at the sugar house, and it's really quite amazing to stand at the tank when the sap is running hard, and to just see all this liquid from all these trees just pouring out of the end of the line. It's
how much does each tree produce in a day?
Good question. In a day,
And does that depend on weather conditions?
That completely depends on weather conditions, which we can talk some more about. Maple sugaring is probably one of the most weather-dependent agricultural operations there is.
Dependent on what kind of weather?
Dependent on the kind of weather that we get in the Northeast in the early spring, when the days begin to warm up above freezing and the nights are still cold. But look, let me answer this question. In the course of a season, you expect to get somewhere between a quart and a half gallon of syrup from each tap, which is the little hole in the tree, right?
That's after it's boiled down.
Now,
so how many gallons of sap does it take to make a quart of syrup?
It takes the ratio of sap to syrup is about 40 to 1.
Good.
Wow.
And that's if you have very sweet sap. It can be as much as 60 to 1.
So sap varies in content. Is that because of the terroir?
Sap varies in sugar content, and it's because of the terroir, and it also has to do with the time and the season.
And the amount of rainfall, maybe, or snow?
Rainfall is an important factor, or the snow cover. The moisture in the ground is an important factor affecting, you know, what kind of season you're going to have. You want a lot of moisture in the ground.
This season has been good for you guys.
This season has been good for us.
We had a ton of snow.
Yeah, we've had a lot of snow, although actually in northern Vermont, you'd be surprised. We haven't gotten as many of these big storms as you have in New York.
Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of them passed just to the south of us. But we've got right now, March, what's today, the 5th, 6th? We've probably got close to 4 feet of snow in the woods.
So now, I have so many questions. It's so interesting. Only one hole per tree?
Pretty much. We have some really giant, really old trees, probably 200 or 300 years old. And in those, we might put two.
And where on a tree is the best place to do it?
Anywhere you can reach that won't be covered by snow. The important thing with that, really, the sap is rising in the cambium layer of the tree, the outside.
Mm-hmm. Under the bark.
Under the bark. And so really anywhere around the tree that's not so low that it would be covered with snow and not so high that you can't reach it is fine. The important thing there is that in successive years, you make sure that you don't put those holes too close to each other. Because obviously, when you put a little hole in a tree, it's no big stress on the tree. The tree doesn't mind very much, but it does need to heal that hole over time. So, you know, next year, you don't want to put another hole right next to the one from the previous year. You want to put it somewhere else.
And you wouldn't put it back in the same place.
No, you wouldn't put
it
back.
Why not?
You wouldn't get much from that because the...
Does it make scar tissue?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, and you would still see the hole. I mean, does it ever fully repair itself?
Yes, sure. In just a few years, it'll get to the point where you can't really find it anymore.
Now, tell us about the land you picked. I mean, did you pick that property based off of knowing that you were going to be a maple syrup producer? Or did you just say one day, why aren't we producing maple syrup? I have hundreds of trees. And are all the trees up there producing maple syrup? I mean, tell us a little bit about the tree component.
Well, as far as our land and our sugar bush, we bought that land 27 years ago because we were looking to buy a sugar bush.
And so were you looking for? Because I know you can try to buy a sugar bush and not buy the best piece of property. So what were you looking for?
This is true. Well, we were looking for a big stand of maples.
How many maple trees do you have, Christopher?
We currently tap a little over 5,000.
Good Lord. I was thinking like, you know, a couple hundred.
No, they're selling at Union Square year round.
We wouldn't be able to supply all our customers at Union Square and in the city if we were only tapping a couple hundred. No, it's about a little more than 5,000. We just wanted to find a good, strong, healthy sugar bush. And let me just digress a little here because I keep using these terms, and I think it's really interesting.
Let's explain.
May I?
Yeah.
The whole process of making maple syrup in the northeastern United States and in Canada, which, by the way, is really the only where in the world it's done on any kind of large scale.
So not Oregon or any other
places? No, out to the Midwest, yes. Mm-hmm. But it all comes from knowledge that the indigenous Americans had when the European colonists arrived, but that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the whole process is all the terminology refers to sugar. Because obviously we're trying to get maple sugar from the tree. So the thing itself is called sugaring. The person who does it is a sugar maker. The place where you boil the sap to syrup is the sugar house.
It's not a sugar shack?
No, not in Vermont. But that's an interesting thing. That's a good question because Patrick and I were talking the other day. Yes, and he referred to a sugar shack. And I got kind of offended and said, wait a minute, it's not a sugar shack, it's a sugar house. Well, then I actually, a couple days later, I was reading an article about sugaring in Quebec. And in Quebec, they do refer to it as a sugar shack.
Okay.
But in Vermont, we call the building where the maple syrup is made a sugar house. Now, why, you might ask, would you have to have a whole separate building in which to do this thing? Well, a lot of the reason is because if you're taking something that's 1.5%, 2% sugar, and you're trying to produce a syrup, which the end result is about 66.5% sugar,
Wow. You
can imagine you're evaporating a lot of water. Anybody who's ever tried to do it in their kitchen knows that by the time you get some syrup, you've probably peeled all the wallpaper off the walls and the paint is peeling, you know? It's a lot of steam. Wow. So it seemed, you know, like the smarter thing to just build a building, put your operation in there, and actually any traditional sugar house has what we call a cupola, which means there's a hole in the roof with a roof over that, which is just to allow that steam to escape. So when you walk into a sugar house when someone's boiling, making syrup, often the whole room is enveloped in steam. You can't even see across the room.
Hmm. And it smells good, I bet.
It smells great.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Now, just tell
us,
come
on this trip. No
what is some of the art of boiling? So, like, Howie was always like, I need to be in the boiling room. Like, what can go wrong? What is the right way to do it?
Well, lots of things can go wrong. Okay, ideally, you want to take this sap, which again is just barely sweet. You want to reduce it to syrup. You want to evaporate the water away as quickly as possible because at best you're going to be there for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. So you want to boil very shallow. Now, our pans, let me describe the scene.
Yeah, let's hear the setup.
So you're in this wooden building out in the deep in the woods, and inside the building there are metal pans that are six feet wide and 16 feet long. Jeez. These are two pans, a back pan and a front pan, that are connected with, you know, pipes. And all of those pans have sap, and the sap is very shallow. Underneath these pans is a fire. We boil with a wood fire, and we still believe in that. A lot of people are using oil-fired rigs now. That's another issue.
You can explain to us afterwards why.
But we use wood, and so we've got this incredibly hot fire under these huge pans going full bore. You just got to feed that fire and keep it roaring because you want to boil as fast as you can. Well, if you lose sap in any part of the pan and the pan becomes dry, in a matter of minutes, your pan would melt and fall into the fire. Mm-hmm. So all kinds of crazy things can happen because you've got you have to keep everything level so you don't, you know, end up with a dry spot. You want it shallow but not too shallow. Sometimes the sap isn't coming fast enough into one part of the pan or another and it starts to get dry, and then everybody's running around like crazy dumping sap into that to keep, you know, it can get nuts. Mm-hmm. When it's all going well, it's an amazing thing because the sap is coming into the back of the back pan thin like water, and as it proceeds through channels in the pan, slowly but surely it's becoming more and more concentrated. Until finally, in the front pan, it's moving through these channels. And when it finally gets to your spigot, the place where you're drawing it off, ideally, there and only there is it turning into maple syrup. Mm. And to determine that, we use a couple of different methods. We have a thermometer, a dial thermometer on the pan that tells us when it's at the temperature that says it's syrup. We also use a scoop and watch the syrup fall off the scoop. And when it sheets off instead of dripping, it's syrup. Mm-hmm. Then we draw it off into a bucket. And then the final and most important test is with a syrup hydrometer, which gives us a specific density, which tells us the ratio of water to sugar. The laws of the state of Vermont regarding maple syrup are the most strict of anywhere. And in Vermont, we're allowed only a one-point variation on the hydrometer, because if syrup is too thin, bacteria will, you know, it'll go bad. If it's too thick, sugars will precipitate out of it, and you'll have grainy syrup. So it has to be perfect.
Wow. And that brings us right into a discussion of grading. And I know that consumers have seen that there are a variety of different grades that are available. Can you take us through some of those? And
sure.
What's desirable, what isn't, and what's worth paying more for, that kind of stuff.
In our 26, almost 27 years at Green Market, the most commonly asked question is, what's the difference between light and dark?
By the way, that's amazing. 26, 27 years at Green Market. You're talking about, you know, one of the oldest stands at Green Market, but that's not what we're talking about, but that's another story.
Yeah, that's another story. But where were we?
Grading.
Oh, grading, excuse me. So, what's the difference between light and dark? Well, maple syrup is graded by color, and corresponding to that color, the darker the syrup, the stronger the flavor tends to be. Now, that's the short answer. The longer answer is that generally, early in the season, the trees are still very dormant. There aren't a lot of the sap that's in the tree is mostly water and sugar. The tree hasn't begun to release the other compounds that it will release later as the spring warms up.
So and those generally, are the compounds that help it produce leaves? Or why should we care about that?
The sap is what's producing. The sap is the tree's food.
Yeah.
And it's going to make the new leaves. And it's rising up in the tree in the spring. So what it matters to the color and the flavor is that generally early in the season, when the weather is still quite cold, the syrup will be very light in color and very delicate in flavor. As the spring warms up, the sap darkens and makes darker syrup with stronger flavor, a little more complex flavor. There are four grades of maple syrup in Vermont, actually five. From very light to very dark. The lightest is called fancy. And was traditionally, historically, the most preferred. It's also the most difficult to make.
Really?
It requires a lot of skill. And it requires really, really ideal weather conditions. The next grade darker is grade A medium amber. And in medium amber, you begin to taste some of these more complicated flavors. You get a little more caramelization, a little more buttery. And then the next grade is grade A dark amber, which is probably the most, it's the flavor people associate most with that very traditional, oh, maple. Because now you've got a lot of stuff going on in there. You've got caramelization. You've got that buttery flavor. You're tasting some of the vanillins that were in the tree sap. But you're also tasting the stronger flavors of the caramelization process. Maybe it's a little smokier. It's a stronger, more intense flavor. The darkest grade that can be sold retail is grade B, mm-hmm. Which a lot of people love. It's very strong. It's a very intense flavor. And sometimes, because as the spring warms up and the trees get close to budding, the trees will begin to release compounds that are actually bitter and a little astringent. And when you have just a little bit of that in the syrup, it's interesting. And, you know, people who love strong flavors love all that stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Beyond grade B is a grade in Vermont we call commercial.
Grade C?
Grade C.
Or C for commercial.
Commercial grade. That's going to be so full of bitterness and astringency that, as someone said it, it's kind of the color and flavor of motor oil.
So you sell that in New Hampshire?
We don't sell that at all. That gets sold pretty much for industrial use. I mean, industrial food use, where you might see something that says with real Vermont maple syrup. Mm. Well,
that's what's in it.
That's maybe what's in it. Yeah. So the answer to like which is the best, it's whatever you like best. Mm-hmm. It's really personal preference.
Well, I can't think of any reason why I would not want a more maple flavor than a less maple.
Well, actually, the more of the maple of the B is actually it pushes a single taste kind of through. It's like more of a punch in the stomach, but you really get the maple. Whereas the A is, you know, a little bit more vanilla. There's more complexity to it. So actually goes opposite than what you would think. It's, you know, like with beer, for instance, the darker beers should be the better beers. But with syrup, it kind of reverses itself.
Yeah. I mean, I really, at this point, I stay away from the better, worse. You know,
sure.
It's personal preference. But what Patrick said is very true. That when you get to a grade B, yeah, if you're somebody who likes a punch in the, you know,
in the taste buds.
A punch in the taste buds, you're going to like it. But what happens is it overwhelms some of those lovely, complex vanillins and butter and the stuff that's going on in the lighter syrup. I always say, you know, in a well-stocked kitchen, you really ought to have a couple of grades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do. I have that luxury. You know, if I'm making, say I'm making a pecan pie or I'm making baked beans, I'm probably going to use a darker syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even grade B, because that flavor will come through when I cook with it or bake with it. But I think it's a little indelicate for pancakes or for vanilla ice cream.
So why don't we take a 30-second break and let Jack grab his breath and break the segment up, and we will come right back. And
Stephen Cantor.
Yeah, final part of the interview. It's great.
He wakes up early in the morning, puts on his only blue suit. He hasn't quite mastered tying his tie on the way his sweet Sarah used to. It's been years since he's talked to the good Lord. He's not sure he front are today. He goes to church on Sundays now. No, he don't know the words to the old rugged cross, but he sings them the best that he can.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my co-host and partner in crime, Patrick Martins, and
crime
our guest.
Is right.
Our guest today is Stefan Kanter from the upper northern reaches of the great state of Vermont. Mm-hmm. And Stefan is telling us all about maple sugaring, because that's what she and her husband Howie do. They make maple syrup, and they've been bringing it down to New York and the New York City green markets for the last 27 years. So welcome back. And
thank you.
We were just, we had several questions. In fact, we could hardly decide whose question was more important.
No, nutrition. I that's what you brought up.
Let's talk for a second about the nutrition of maple syrup, because it is one of the oldest. I mean, certainly in American, early American cuisine, this was pretty much our only sugar source. Tell us a little bit about the nutritional values of maple syrup, which are totally different from cane sugar and
sorghum
and the other sweeteners that we have come to rely on in this around the world.
Sure. Actually, maple syrup is different from cane sugar or beet sugar because it actually has nutritional content.
It has. You said earlier that the tree is bringing minerals up through the sap. I imagine those minerals.
Those minerals are present in the syrup.
Right?
Yes, those minerals are present in the syrup. They're really good for you. In a sense, it's like honey in that it's a sweetener that has a lot of beneficial minerals. But the great thing is that they're different ones. So you know, eat honey, eat maple, you get a well-rounded mineral intake. Two of the most important and most abundant minerals in maple syrup are magnesium and potassium.
Great for your heart.
Yes, and for your digestion, which is interesting. Mm. I sort of just put this together. It's you know, there's a lot of old wisdom and traditional knowledge about things like this, and I've always heard that maple syrup is good for digestion. Mm. But you know,
why?
Well, I recently learned it's partly because magnesium and potassium are minerals that are that are required for healthy digestion. Hmm. So when you're deficient in those, you're going to have digestive troubles. So
you mean, like, I have heartburn all the time. If I ate a spoonful of maple syrup every day, I would have less heartburn?
Probably.
I'm going to try it.
Is probably. That why in that maple syrup, lemon, and cayenne pepper diet, is it maybe that the syrup helps with the digestion part of that? I mean, you've heard about that diet,
of
right?
Of course I have. I'm so glad you brought this up.
Why? Because we're about to start it.
I am so glad you've given me an opportunity to speak to this, may I?
But yes. You must be pro, because it's more maple syrup sales.
I am absolutely pro. I think it's a great... Okay, this is a cleansing fast.
Mm-hmm.
Where you make a lemonade, basically. Maple syrup, cayenne pepper, and lemon juice in water.
In a big jug, and you carry it around with you the whole day.
Whatever.
Patrick and I are going to do that this week.
You do it as many days as you want. You eat nothing else. You drink nothing else. Just this.
But you can drink as much as you want.
Exactly. Now, I think it's a wonderful thing, and probably, I mean, I haven't really done it.
You mean I can't add a shot of whiskey to it?
I've done it.
Well, you can, but it wouldn't quite be the same thing. but I know a lot of people have and totally attest to it. We sell quite a lot of syrup in the market to people who want to do the fast.
You do 8 days, 7 days, 8 days, and you will lose 10 to 15 pounds, period. Like, if you really do it, you just will. And the cayenne, this is what I guess, the cayenne triggers something in your brain that thinks you're eating like a meat or a savory.
I thought
something.
The maple syrup.
But the maple syrup does that as well.
As well, yeah.
That's a lot of insulin. Yes, that's a lot of what's going on there. Okay. That maple syrup and the cayenne sort of satisfy, you know, your brain in terms of it. But this is important. The man who developed this diet lived in California. And he could understand the benefits of maple syrup, but the thing is, he really had no idea how maple syrup is produced. And so in his book, he states that you must use grade B And he says that the reason is because it's less refined. I have spent 27 years trying to correct this piece of misinformation. Mm-hmm. There is no refining in any maple syrup. It all contains the beneficial minerals. Mm-hmm. It's all fine to use for the cleansing fast. You
Good
do
news.
Not have to use grade B. If you want to, great. No problem. But I just, you know, I so many people walk up to the stand at the market and they, I got to have grade B because I'm doing this fast. And I say, okay. But, you know, well, actually, I used to argue with them a little. I've kind of given up. Because,
absolutely.
Because the problem is they believe this guy in California who wrote the book mm-hmm. instead of me who makes maple syrup. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. I'll sell you what you want. And then at one point I thought, okay, I'm going to get in touch with this guy and I'm going to straighten him out. Well, unfortunately, he passed away, so I can't do that. So
he was very slim when he passed away.
He was right.
So you have not tried this yourself?
No. Well, I did it like for a day.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'd be really mean if I'm I did that.
I'm not much
for
of a
days.
Faster. I really love to eat.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about doing it in conjunction with a quinoa diet. Uh-huh. I thought that would be good.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
High protein.
Let us know.
Yeah.
So is syrup is good for you? So, I mean, if
syrup
you're going
to... good for you.
Honey or syrup
yes.
is what should be used as sweeteners as opposed to cane or beet sugar, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, we make a... I mean, if you continue to boil the syrup, once you've got syrup and you keep going, you mm-hmm. keep evaporating water out of it, you're going to reach some other states of chemistry. The final one being when you've evaporated every bit of water out of it and you'll end up with granulated maple sugar.
Mm-hmm. And that's maple sugar candy.
No, actually, maple sugar candy would be a step back from that. There's still some moisture in the maple sugar candy.
That's true.
You can use the maple sugar candy. You could pound it up and put it in something to sweeten it. But the lovely thing about the granulated maple sugar is that it absolutely will replace white sugar in any recipe.
Hmm. Great.
So, I mean, it has the qualities you need for baking, for example. Mm-hmm. So we sell a lot of maple sugar to pastry chefs and people who are doing mm-hmm. some serious baking and want a good substitute for white sugar. But you can also use maple syrup. I mean, that's the major sweetener in our house, obviously. I put it in everything. When my kids were little, I sweetened their Kool-Aid with maple syrup.
Oh, man. So now, who first figured it out that you could drill a hole in a tree and produce something delicious?
I love that question because it's my particular interest. I have a background
with your
anthropology
master's in global studies, too.
Well, my background is anthropology, and I've been always fascinated by this. The process of making maple syrup was figured out by indigenous Americans. We're not really sure when in history this happened. So when the European colonists first came to the United States, to North America, it was the indigenous Americans who taught them how to do it.
And that could have been maybe a mistake that one day an arrow goes into a tree and this delicious substance comes out?
Well, I think it would have been more likely an observation that certain forest animals, squirrels, for example, were attracted to, say, a place where a tree, a limb had broken off, the sap falls out, some of it evaporates away, and there's this sweet, sticky stuff left, and the squirrels are licking it, and somebody says, you know, let's put the finger in there. That's pretty good.
I hope it's not lie.
yeah, exactly.
I'm currently involved in a little personal research project to understand better how the indigenous people made syrup, where that knowledge came from, how it was developed, and especially that moment in time when the transfer of that knowledge happened between the Native Americans and the European colonists. I'm completely fascinated by that. So it's a project I'm working on right now, so maybe when I know more, I'll come back
on,
would be
for
great.
Sure.
Talk about it.
Well, we'll be looking for your book on the subject, Stefan.
Now, tell us about like some things that frustrate you in the industry. I mean, obviously, people making false claims is one, but I mean, is there a bad way to make maple syrup?
What's different about you? Let's backtrack. What's different about your way than the way it's made commercially?
Well, I want to address this question. Like any agricultural pursuit, there are a lot of pressures right now, financial and otherwise, to produce more, cheaper, faster. Mm-hmm. And like any other thing, that's probably goes along with a loss of quality, because when you're trying to do something more, cheaper, faster, you're not really paying attention to what's most important about that food. So I've recently said, to me, maple syrup is the ultimate slow food. Absolutely. Maple trees themselves take their time. They grow very slowly. They live to be hundreds of years old. And the process of making syrup is one of the most simple culinary concepts. It's just reduction. You're just reducing this sap, concentrating the sugars, concentrating the flavors until you've achieved syrup. But you do that with the introduction of heat. And that heat is completely critical to the whole thing, the flavor that you're going to have as the end result, because the caramelization brings flavor into the thing. The breaking down of the fructose and the glucose in the syrup, which adds all kinds of flavor. All of this is important to the quality of the end product. So for Howie and myself, one of the most disturbing trends in the maple sugaring in recent years is maybe not the use, but the overuse of a process called reverse osmosis, whereby water is taken out of the sap before you ever begin to boil it. And when you reverse osmosis, machines are quite expensive, but what they're going to do for you, should you decide to purchase one and use it, is if you can take a bunch of water out of the sap before you start to boil it, obviously you're not going to have to cook it as long to end up with syrup.
You use less fuel.
You use less fuel. It takes less time. So you can see that would be very attractive to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, when you do that, you're not simmering the syrup for hours. You know, you're not cooking it as long. You're not getting all that complexity of flavor. And we know people, this is becoming very widespread in maple syrup production. And anybody with a really big operation probably is using RO, reverse osmosis. Now, individually, how far you take that, how much water you take out before you begin to cook it, is up to you as the individual producer. So we know people, for example, who use the RO, but they bring it maybe from 2% sugar to 5 or 6%. And so the cooking process is still really all there. And if I tasted that syrup and compared it to our syrup, I might not notice much flavor difference. But when you start getting up to 15, 16, 18% sugar, meaning you've taken out a lot of the water,
right?
You can cook it really fast and go back to the TV show. you're losing something in quality. Now, this is my subjective opinion, but I believe it. And I think it's a very sad thing, because the state of Vermont, which has always been right on it as far as really strict standards, is completely ignoring what's going on here with this. There is absolutely no governance of what you do with your RO machine. So while Vermont is, still claiming, we have the highest standards in the world and everybody's all concerned with the grades. Back to the question about grades. Maple syrup is graded strictly and only by color. The color is it. So I can make an inferior tasting syrup that has the color that I'm after. I can sell it as pure Vermont maple syrup, but it's not going to taste like what I can do if I actually start with the sap and boil it. If I may just add one more thing, there's a great, fairly new book out by Rowan Jacobson called American Terroir, and one of his chapters is about maple syrup. And he visited with maple sugar makers in Vermont in very high terrain. He calls it high mountain maple syrup, high mountain sugar bushes. And he talks about this high mountain terrain is it's mostly, it's this, you know, bedrock schist and gneiss as opposed to limestone. These trees are very stressed. They're up high on the mountain in the wind. They're struggling just to hang on to the earth. And their sap is not as sweet. Mm-hmm. So maybe, and our sugar bushes actually would qualify in under his criteria as one of these high mountain sugar bushes. So the sap from a sugar bush like that is probably going to be 50 or 60 to 1. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to boil my sap longer to get syrup. And again, by doing that, I'm going to end up with a syrup that is of higher quality, as any wine aficionado would recognize this, that the best wine is made from the grapes that are under some stress.
Yeah, you're always trying to stress them out.
And it's the same with maple trees. And it's the same, actually, with any, you know, food, vegetable grown organically. Mm-hmm. If that vegetable has to fight to survive, it's going to be full of all kinds of things that taste really good.
Its anger leads to explosive taste. Well, we do have only a couple minutes left, so you're going to have to, in under a minute, there are two things I just have to ask about. First of all, the Roberta's of the Northeast Kingdom is Parker Pie. That is such an amazing, fun clubhouse for that region. They didn't really have a clubhouse until your son opened it. So
that
give
is
us
true.
A brief summary of that place.
Well, thanks. Great to have an opportunity to put in a word for Parker Pie Company, which is located in West Glover, Vermont. And I tell you, without a doubt, makes the best pizza north of New York City. That's my completely objective opinion.
Is New Haven, wow. Slapper against New Haven right
excuse
there.
Excuse me. Well, I would actually, if I wasn't sitting in New York, I would might say the best in the world. But anyway, yes, my son opened a restaurant in West Glover, but it's a much more than a restaurant. It has become a wonderful community gathering place that we didn't have before. He actually opened it in the back of the old general store where there had been a bar most recently in the 1850s.
Wow.
So now we have a wonderful pub and a pizzeria, wonderful young chefs who do incredible things, Laura
like
Thompson
Roberta's,
and Ben Trevitz.
Looks like Roberta's just with the people are wearing more layers of clothing.
Exactly.
Looks like the big
Exactly. So, yeah.
And probably not as much ink.
Come to West Glover and stop at Parker Pie.
And then also, if you go up to that part, there's an amazing museum, the Bread and Puppet Museum, which is a free museum. You just walk in. There's not really anyone there. You could just, like, touch these amazing massive puppets. And you and Howie had a seminal relationship with the Bread and Puppet movement.
Yeah, Bread and Puppet Theater is actually started in New York City in the early 60s, moved to Vermont in the 70s, and both Howie and I have been working with Bread and Puppet for over 30 years. We don't so much anymore because we've got a lot of other things going on, but we're still very connected with the theater. That's our theater family. And Bread and Puppet Theater still tours the world year-round to make a living, but is home in Vermont in the summer, running performances at the theater's farm every Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And the Puppet Museum, the Bread and Puppet Museum, is housed in a beautiful old barn.
Yeah, it's a lovely place.
Former dairy farm, and quite an extraordinary, spectacular collection of
like haunting almost
puppets
when you
and
walk
the
in
work
there.
Of Bread and Puppet Theater for the last 40 years. This is puppet theater for grown-ups.
Absolutely. Well, our listeners can taste Stefan's maple syrup at Union Square Market
every Friday and Saturday year-round. And may I also add that We sell our syrup to a lot of restaurants in the city, and we hope that you will all try and frequent those. Visit our website, which is deepmountainmaple.com. We do not sell our syrup online or by mail order, but
you will be able to buy it for months.
Yes, but Heritage Foods.
Heritage Foods USA. Heritage Foods USA is selling a liter of this syrup a couple of days after the actual boiling, or a week or so after. And Andrea Trabuco Campos is the head of mail order for Heritage Foods, and he's organizing an expedition north with the documentary team and with Muscle to help put the syrup into jugs, and for $45, including delivery, you can get a liter of syrup delivered to your home just really within a few days of flowing in a tree. So go on
and
to Heritage.
And knowing that it was made in this old-fashioned, time-honored tradition.
Yes,
so very cool.
So get in touch with Heritage Foods and order some maple syrup.
Absolutely.
Or stop by and see us at the market. Check out our website, because it's meant to be information and education about maple. And on the chef's page, you will find a listing of the restaurants in the city where our syrup is served.
Well, fantastic. This has been a great show. We had Dave Arnold, and then we had Stefan Cantor. And next week, very excited to have Gus Schumacher, who is the
former Undersecretary of Agriculture for the Clinton administration and a major mover and shaker in the food world.
And a very close friend of Michael Batterbury, yes, who we talked about earlier.
Today, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, great show. Stay tuned in the next weeks for more news on the syrup and more news, on food movement in general. Thank you, Jack Inslee, executive producer.
And thanks to our sponsor.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA. In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house, where it is boiled gently over a wood fire, just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1-liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join wine impresarios Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco as they dish out on the latest industry news with winemakers and tastemakers on Heritage Radio Network's revamped wine show, Unfiltered. Aaron Fitzpatrick, one of the first hosts on HRN with her program At the Root of It, amps up the volume and unfiltered content with co-host Brian DeMarco in this 2011 Redux. True to the original format, Aaron and Brian will keep you abreast of current happenings and break down the news and global events, distilling complex into anecdotal stories that inspire. From media and political events to hailstorms in Argentina, no topic is out of bounds. Tune in every week to hear them chat up the industry's biggest personalities and host on-air tastings with visiting vintners and the country's hottest sommeliers. Whether you're an expert or an enthusiast, Unfiltered demystifies wine and lets you know what it really takes to get a bottle from the vineyard to your neighborhood wine shop. Unfiltered broadcasts live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? to kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.